So today I'm going to talk about hydrocephalus, but one of the things that struck me about hydrocephalus is it seems to be most prevalent in infants and in the elderly. So I thought maybe there is some sort of aging effects going on, and this talk will describe my investigations into this idea. This thanks my collaborators, Karina and Siv, of course. Okay, so the outline of my talk will be pretty straightforward. I'm going to first describe what kind of structural changes occur due to aging and the natural aging from infancy all the way to old age. And then I'll talk about some mechanical properties of the brain and how they actually depend on age. And then I will look at hydrocephalus, but specifically what I call pulsatile damage hypothesis of hydrocephalus, so looking at the effect of CSF pulsations on hydrocephalus, and then finally summarize. Okay, so the brain tissue is composed of four main components. You have neurons, the glial cells, the blood vessels, and the extracellular matrix. So neurons, the human brain has about 10 billion neurons, and each one is interconnecting to about 1,000 other neurons. So it's a big tangled kind of soup of neurons that we see here. And surrounding all of these neurons are glial cells, and they function to provide support to the neurons. So they clean up dead neural cells, they provide the chemicals necessary for the signal transduction, they all sorts of provide physical and chemical support. And then we have blood vessels that provide our nutrients, and then the extracellular matrix, which is mainly composed in the brain of a family of proteoglycans called lectocans, instead of what we normally think of in extracellular matrix, which is collagen and fibronectin. Okay. So what kind of changes occur due to aging? Well, from 4 months after conception, all the way to about 24 to 30 months of age, is what is called the period of the brain growth spurt. Okay, so this is when there's an extraordinary period of biochemical activity in the brain, where we're generating new cellular components, we're myelinating the axons, we're creating new connections, etc. And the unfused skull plates allow the brain to grow at a very abnormal rate in this period. This graph down here shows the brain growth velocity as a function of weight, and you can see that the fastest growth really occurs right around birth to 1 year. Okay, and during this time we can measure that there is a significant increase in DNAP content in the brain, which is the number of measure of total cell number. There's an increase in lipid content due to the myelination of the axons, and there's a significant decrease in water that levels off from about 94% water to about 80% water for the rest of the lifetime of the brain. Also very important during this brain growth spurt is the fact that the blood-brain barrier is reduced, is relaxed. So this allows nutrients and other components necessary for this extreme growth to be absorbed into the brain and used by the cells. This also makes the brain very susceptible to injury at this time because of the relaxed barrier. Now, in aging, natural aging, we see a flattening and calcification of the choroid plexus epithelium as well as the basement membrane. And this is believed to reduce the CSF production, the ion transport, and fluid filtration in the brain. In normal pressure hydrocephalus, they've also measured a increased resistance to CSF flow and increased intracranial pressure amplitude that increases with age. In the CSF production rate and the cranial compliance have been measured to decrease with age. Okay, but perhaps most strikingly, you can see here is just the brain shrinks with age. So neurons die, they don't get replaced. This is brain volume over intracranial volume. So as we age, our brain shrinks and is replaced by CSF. Okay, so when I looked at this data, I thought, well, you have this period of incredible growth where we're formulating new connections, we're adding cellular content, and then in old age, things start to slowly degenerate. So this means that what I think is that the mechanical properties of the brain should reflect this period of growth, maturation, and degeneration, and that the mechanical properties are actually age-dependent. Unfortunately, in most of the work that's done nowadays, we are still treating infant brains as miniature adult brains. So we just treat mechanical properties as one number that is valid for a whole lifespan. And when we need mechanical properties specifically for infants, we just scale the adult parameters. Okay, and so for hydrocephalus and other conditions that seem to be age-dependent, I think that this means we should be using age-dependent mechanical properties. This is just an example of age dependence. So due to the difficulty of acquiring actual human experimental data on brain tissue, we usually infer the mechanical properties of brain from either animal experiments, or for infants, we infer them from adult experiments. So this is an example of a scaling relationship that's used to determine the angular rotation injury threshold for what is prototype. It could stand for the human or an infant. And this is the angular rotation acceleration of the model that you're using. And this is the relationship that we would be able to determine how much injury can an infant brain sustain, given that we know how much injury an adult brain could sustain. Unfortunately, these types of scaling relationships assume that all the material properties are the same between your model and your prototype. So density is the same, shear modulus is the same, all the mechanical properties are the same. It's assuming that the materials are linearly elastic. It's assuming that there's no effect due to the unfused sutures of an infant skull. And in this particular case, it predicts that since the mass of the adult brain is larger than the mass of the infant brain, it predicts that the infant brain should be able to sustain much larger rotational accelerations than an infant. Recently, 22 years ago, I guess, Tibble and Margulies actually decided to measure infant brain parameters and adult brain parameters. They used infant and adult porcine cerebrum, and they measured it in vitro, so they actually excised it from dead animals. And they found the shear complex modulus at 20 data points, ranging from 20 to 200 hertz. Okay. Other data that I found that was age-dependent was by Sack et al. In 2009, and they did in vivo experiments using magnetic resonance elastography. Thank you for defining that, Karina. And they found, again, the shear complex modulus, but they looked at patients from 18 to 88 years, so the natural aging process. And unfortunately, they only used four data points, so only four frequency values ranging from 25 to 62.5 hertz. Here I have some examples of the data. So this is the infant porcine storage modulus, and this is the adult porcine storage modulus, and the adult magnetic resonance elastography storage modulus. So you can see that the numbers are somewhat close, but they do vary, and it could be due to the fact that this is pig brain and this is adult brain. It could be due to the fact that this was excised tissue, and this was tissue measurements done inside the cranial vault of living tissue in its CSF bath. So what is shear complex modulus? I just will define this for those people who may not know. It is one of the ways that we can quantify the behavior of a viscoelastic material. Okay, so viscoelastic materials are usually defined based on their creep or relaxation or shear complex modulus behavior. Or complex modulus behavior. So if we use shear a material periodically, then in the long time the stress is given by this relation, where this G star is what we call the complex modulus. Okay? And the complex modulus can be broken up into a real part, which is called the storage modulus, and the complex part, which is called the loss modulus. The storage modulus sort of describes the elastic behavior of the material, and the loss modulus describes the viscous behavior of material, or the dissipative nature. So from the work that Davis et al. Did in 2006, where they showed that the fractional Zener model for viscoelasticity was able to accurately describe the creep and relaxation data of Galford and McElhenney better than other 3 and 4 parameter viscoelastic models, we chose to use this model in our work. And this is a mechanical analog for the Zener model. You have a spring in series with a viscous dashpot coupled in parallel with another spring. In a regular Zener model, this stress of this dashpot is assumed to be proportional to the strain rate, but we're assuming a fractional Zener model, which means we replace the strain rate, the first order derivative here, with the fractional derivative, capital D alpha, where alpha is the order of the fractional derivative. So alpha can vary between 0 and 1. When alpha is 0, this becomes just the strain, and this becomes essentially another spring. When alpha is 1, this becomes the strain rate, and this becomes a regular dashpot. The constitutive equation for the fractional Zener model is given by this equation, where tau is the relaxation time describing the material, E0 is the initial elastic modulus of the material, and E infinity is the steady state elastic modulus of the material. And I'm going to use this model to fit the age-dependent data of Tybalt and Margulies as well as the SAC data. So I found the storage modulus, which is given by this, and the loss modulus, which is given by this expression. And I don't want you to get too afraid of these expressions. I just want you to notice that they are highly nonlinear in terms of the four parameters that we're trying to fit to the data, which are E0, E infinity, tau, and alpha. Lucky for me, there was a function in MATLAB that did this for me, because I'm not very good at linear regression. So this is the result of our curve fitting. These yellow dots here are the storage modulus of the infant data. The green squares are the loss modulus of the infant porcine data. And this is the frequency values down here. The straight line and the dotted line are the fractional Zener model fits to the data. And that results in these parameter values here. This is the same for the adult data, resulting in these parameter values here. And I've included here the result of fitting to the MRE data. I only include this for interest. I don't really trust these values too much because, like I said, I fit a four parameter model to four data points. So it's not very accurate. What I do want to point out, though, is that our steady state elastic modulus of the infant porcine brain is almost half the adult porcine brain. Okay, the initial elastic modulus is significantly less as well. The time scale is larger, and the fractional order of all three fits is almost the same, about 0.8. Okay, this slide was to remind me that we're now going to talk about hydrocephalus. So I don't think I need to describe it because everybody's not expert by now. But what I will talk about is the pulsations of hydrocephalus, pulsations of the brain. So much work has been done experimentally showing that there seems to be some sort of relationship between the CSF pulsations and the formation of hydrocephalus. So I'll just quickly go over these three, what I consider to be the most significant results in the literature. In 1962, Baring showed that if you remove the choroid plexus from one of the lateral ventricles, the one with the lateral ventricle enlarged much more than the one without the lateral ventricle. Okay? And this is assuming that the choroid plexus that he removed is the pulsation generator. Okay? Wilson and Bertin in 1967 showed that if they obstructed the artery, the main artery leading to one of the choroid plexus of the lateral ventricles, then it was smaller and had lower CSF amplitudes than the other one, the unaffected ventricle. And in 1984, DiRocco showed that if he artificially increased the amplitude of the CSF pulsations by inserting a balloon into the ventricle and rhythmically pumping it in rhythm with the CSF pulsations to artificially increase the amplitude, then they observed more dilation in that ventricle than in the other one. So I believe it mostly came out of the work of Biadirocco, this idea of the pulsation damage hypothesis. I made up this name, by the way, so don't go literature searching for it. But this is what I tried to summarize their basic ideas into this hypothesis. And it basically says that the pulsations cause damage to the tissue, and this tissue damage leads to ventricular enlargement. Okay? So their idea is the choroid plexus generates a pulse every time you get an influx of arterial blood. The pulse is transmitted through the incompressible CSF to the ventricle walls. This pressurization cycle on the ventricle walls creates two things. One, it displaces the tissue, so it causes periods of compression and expansion. And two, it causes a little bit of CSF to oscillate in and out of the ventricle, in and out of the ventricle wall and the periventricular tissues. These oscillations may cause large shear stresses and strains that could damage that tissue, and as that tissue becomes damaged, it allows fluid to propagate further into the tissues, propagating the damage further into the tissues and eventually leading to ventricular expansion. So in previous work that I just wanted to summarize here that I did in my PhD, I used a poroelastic model to look at the interaction between the fluid and the solid phases of the brain under the effect of the CSF pulsations. So my poroelastic model predicted a maximum fluid velocity of about 1 micrometer per second in the ventricle wall, or in the periventricular tissues. Okay, this was due to pulsations of about 10 millimeters peak to peak, which is consistent with those observed during the induction of hydrocephalus. I used a simple pipe flow model to get an idea of the shear stresses that would be induced on the tissue by such a flow. And I compared that shear stress to some experience. I was trying to get an idea of, is this capable of causing damage? So I compared it to the force required to rupture a single adhesive bond. And I estimated that that would be about 60,000 micropascals, which is much larger than the 40 micropascals created by the oscillating fluid. So I concluded that the fluid flow really doesn't seem to be possible of causing damage to the tissue. So we only really need to be concerned with the solid phase of the tissue. So in order to look at the effect of the CSF pulsations on the solid phase, we'll move to a viscoelastic material. Assume that the material is homogeneous and isotropic and incompressible, and that we can describe the dilatational parts of the stress-strain tensor as a linear elastic solid, and that the deviatoric parts are going to behave according to our fractional Zener model. Okay, the model setup is a simplified geometry. So this is a normal brain, and this is a hydrocephalic brain. And you can see, if you just look at this part, that when the ventricles are expanded, it approximately looks like a thick-walled cylinder. So we take this to be our simplified geometry, just a thick-walled cylinder where we generalize the whole inside of the cylinder to be a ventricle, or the ventricles, and the outside to be the subarachnoid space and the skull. We'll assume planar strains here to make the analysis simpler, and that leaves us to solve our quasi-static equation of motion. The boundary conditions on the inside of the cylinder where the ventricles are, we apply the condition that states that the radial stress, so the stress normal to the ventricle walls, should be equal to the pressure of the CSF pulsations. Okay? Now at the outside of the brain, there's two different conditions, one that we prescribe for infants and one that we prescribe for adults, based on the fact that the infant skull is unfused, okay? So for the infant case, we prescribe zero stress, and this allows the skull to expand if it needs to. And the adult condition, we prescribe zero displacement because the skull is rigid and it would restrict movement. And solving that equation with those boundary conditions, using the elastic viscoelastic correspondence principle, we get these two expressions here. This is the displacement for the adult for the infant, and this is the displacement for the adult. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it too much, but I'll say that this funny-looking function here is just a generalization of the exponential function, and it's called the Mittag-Leffler function. So for model parameters, I assume that the CSF pressure is of the form of an amplitude times a cosine, so just a simple periodic pulse amplitude. And I apply 5 millimeter mercury amplitude and about 70 beats per minute frequency. And I use the fractional Zener model parameters determined by Davis et al. From fitting to the relaxation data of Galford and McElney. I do this first in order to compare with the age dependence that I'll show you in a minute. So these are the parameter values that they found fitting to the relaxation data. And I assume approximate size of an adult head. I use this for both infants and adults just in order to compare the effect of the parameters instead of also the geometry. So this is the displacement predicted by the infant boundary value problem and the adult boundary value problem. So I've summarized it down here. The infant ventricle displaces a maximum of 3 millimeters or 6 millimeters peak to peak, and the cortical surface in the infant displaces about 2 millimeters peak to peak, whereas in the adult, where the skull is rigid, we have a displacement of about 100 nanometers peak to peak, or 0.1 micrometers, and zero displacement of the cortical surface. The tissue stresses, in the infant case, they range from 670 pascals in amplitude radially to 800 pascals tangentially, and in the adult, they're both about 670 pascals. So I was using the Davis model parameters, okay? So then when I go and I put in the age-dependent model parameters that I determined by fitting to Tibble and Margulies' data, I find that the infant ventricle wall displaces 35 millimeters. Now, this is a problem because the ventricle wall is only 30 millimeters from the origin, meaning that this is an unphysical result. It can't displace 35 millimeters towards the center when there's only 30 millimeters of room there. So this means something is wrong in this infant model. Okay? The adult model, on the other hand, predicts almost exactly the same displacement using the adult parameter values. So in order to fix the infant boundary value problem, I concluded that the zero stress condition at the outer surface was just too weak. It's just a simplification that mathematicians like to use because it's easy to solve. So instead, I introduced what I call a mixed boundary condition, where I said that the radial stress at the cortical surface is actually equal to a percentage or a fraction of the radial stress that's present in the adult case. So this is saying that the infant skull is providing a percentage of the resistive force that the adult skull provides. And the only problem with this boundary condition is I don't know what that fraction is. Margulies and Tibble did some simulations in this paper from 2000 where they simulated the infant skull with the unfused sutures and the adult skull with the fused sutures. And they applied a 5,000 Newton load and found that the infant skull deformed 10 millimeters, the adult skull deformed 4 millimeters for a ratio of 0.4. Under 1,000 Newton load, the ratio is 0.5. Now, the only problem with this is a 5,000 Newton load is like having a 500 kilogram animal standing on the skull of an infant, which is much more significant a load than the pulsations of the brain. So while this gives me an idea of the value of delta, I don't expect that my delta should actually be near this range. This is the displacement predicted by the mixed boundary condition infant using the infant parameter values using a value of delta is 0.5. And it predicts displacements of about 17.5 millimeters. Okay, so at least it's physical, but it's still quite large. This plot shows how much the displaced, the maximum displacement is as delta varies. So if delta is zero, again I have zero stress at the outer boundary, and again I have my unphysical displacement. As delta increases, you end up with, at delta equals 0.1, you have the full stress of the rigid skull, so again you get 48 nanometers. And I picked a physically reasonable value of 0.5 millimeters, and that corresponded to a value of delta is about 0.86. So this means that the infant skull provides about 86% of the resistive force that the adult skull provides at loads consistent with the pulsations of the CSF. So to summarize the parameter values that I used here, this is the relaxation data found by Davis et al. This is the adult parameters based on my curve fitting to the magnetic resonance elastography. This is the adult based on my fitting to the porcine data, and the infant values based on fitting to the porcine data. What's interesting to me is that the steady state elastic modulus is much more reduced in infant and is about 1,000 in the adult. I also calculated the shear modulus based on this relation here. Comparing to other values of the Young's modulus used in the literature, Taylor Miller, in a study they did in 2004 looking at hydrocephalus, used an elastic modulus of 584, which is close to my value of 621. But they were using this for adults. And Cheng and Bilson found a value of 350 pascals, which is almost half of what I found for the infant. A summary of the model predictions now. So using the infant relaxation, we found 3 millimeters and 670 to 800 pascal shears, stresses. And the infant mixed boundary condition with delta is 0.86, we got 5, and our stresses are still in the same range. Measure of total shear stress is an indicator of where the damage is most likely to occur, and this function decreases with R, indicating that the maximum stress occurs at the ventricle wall, which is what we expected. Now, my question is, how do I compare the stresses predicted in the tissue from this model to its ability to actually to damage the tissue? So I found this paper by Francescini et al. Where they used some white matter and applied a stretch to it until it fractured, and they measured the stress. So there was the initial stiff phase, and then it transitioned to a hardening phase, then a locking phase, a secondary hardening phase, and then a softening phase, and then ultimately leading to the fracture point. And the typical definition in engineering for damage initiation is that transition from the locking to the hardening. So they measured that to be about around here, I think, and they found that that threshold is about 2.7 kilopascals before damage starts to be initiated in the tissue. So 2,700 pascals is about, the stress is predicted by our model about 30% of that threshold limit. So I concluded that it seems unlikely that the CSF pulsations are capable of causing damage to the tissues. In terms of the steady-state elastic modulus, what I found very interesting was that in infants it was 600 pascals, in adults it was about 1,000 pascals, and I did a sensitivity analysis that showed that in the range from 500 to 10,000 pascals, it most significantly affected the results of our model. Furthermore, SAC found that the storage and the loss moduli decreased with age in the adults from 18 to 88 years. So thinking about this, I conjectured that the steady-state elastic modulus increases from its infancy value to a maximum at early adulthood, which would be about 20 years of age, and then it slowly decreases again with age. And if this conjecture is true, it could help to explain why hydrocephalus is most prevalent in infants and elderly because of the reduced elastic modulus that makes the brain tissue more easily deformed. So in terms of age dependence, We have the brain growth spurt and the degeneration affecting age, affecting the mechanical properties of the brain tissue. So we should be using age-dependent brain tissues when we're looking at conditions such as hydrocephalus that seem to be related to the age of the patient. And when we use these age-dependent parameters, it's entirely possible that they might break our mathematical models and we'll have to do some modification. So in terms of the pulsation damage hypothesis, I've looked at both the fluid effect on the tissue, and I estimated that the shear was very unlikely to damage the tissue. I looked at the tissue movements itself and estimated that the stresses induced by the CSF on the tissue were pretty unlikely at causing the brain damage, the tissue damage as well. And thus I concluded that CSF pulsations cannot be the primary cause of the tissue damage that's observed in hydrocephalus or the ventricular enlargement. So looking to the future, I would like to correct a few things that I see to be limitations in my model. The first one being the model I didn't really talk about, but the poroelastic model, where you have the oscillating fluid in and out of the brain tissue. So I calculated the damage threshold based on shear flows, which is what's available in the literature. But in actuality, that flow is periodic in nature, so it's flushing in and out of the brain tissue. And it has been shown that oscillatory shear flows can trigger cellular responses different than steady shear flows. For example, in the development of heart valves, it's the backward flow of blood that the cells sense that causes the cells to initiate the development, the growth of valves in the heart. So it's possible that the oscillatory nature of the flow is triggering some kind of response from the cells in the periventricular tissue that may be leading to damage, but this would have to be determined experimentally. Furthermore, I'd like to continue looking at the age-dependent behavior of brain tissue, and I'd like to look at not just the complex modulus, but also the creep and relaxation characteristics of the tissue. And in terms of the complex modulus, I think using the MRE methodology is very exciting because you actually get to measure living brain tissue inside the cranial vault, again, in its natural environment, in its CSF bath. But much more frequency values will be needed in order to achieve data fitting for our 3 and 4 parameter models. And it would be really interesting to use animal subjects that ranged from infancy to old age in order to test my conjecture on the age dependence of the steady state elastic modulus. So this conjecture that I made, it may help to explain why we see hydrocephalus most commonly in infants and elderly. And I think that future work will go in the direction that Karina was talking about with the triphasic models to actually look at the changes that occur in the microstructure of the brain and determine what chemical and biological changes are occurring as it grows and develops and ages, and also in pathological states like hydrocephalus. So a polymer model introduces this third phase, which is the ionic phase, that allows you to consider things like a swelling or contracting gel. So you can think of a swelling brain causing slit ventricle syndrome and a contracting brain causing hydrocephalus. And that's it. This one? Yeah, so this relaxation time comes from Davis's fitting to relaxation data. So this is an accurate relaxation time for brain tissue. These relaxation times come from my curve fittings to the complex modulus data, and I think that they're obviously wrong if you're talking about the actual relaxation behaviors of brain tissue. Yeah. This is fitted to in vitro experiments, right? Yeah, this is fitted, this was the Galford and McElhenney work. Yeah, yeah. I don't think it does either. I was thinking about this for a long time, actually, because our model is kind of inside out in that respect, where we're artificially applying the pulsations to it instead of having the pulsations originate from it. But I think it really doesn't affect the conclusions. Yeah. For this work, I'm only considering timescales on the order of the heartbeat, because I'm just looking at the CSF oscillate, the pulsation. So I'm only looking at like 3 or 4 seconds long. I'm not looking at the full evolution of hydrocephalus, which would be like 2 weeks.